You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 29th of April 2016, right here on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tyler Brûlé. Australia is expanding its submarine fleet, and it's not coming cheap. But is 50, yes, that's 50 billion Australian dollars, a price worth paying for it? And
what we find is that millennials, as they're getting into their late 20s and early 30s, guess what they're doing? They're moving to the suburbs.
We'll ask whether young professionals are starting to ditch city living for the quiet life of suburbia. Also to come, Herman Melville said, "It is better to fail in originality than to succeed in imitation." Was he right? And we'll also look ahead to next week here on Monocle 24, where we'll be discussing whether borders define our identity. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Tyler Brûlé. And it's not just Midori House with me, Tyler Brûlé. It's also Midori House with our editor, Andrew Tuck, and also with our senior correspondent, Sophie Grove. Welcome.
Thank you.
Andrew, what is going on?
What
is going on about a meter and a half above your head right now?
So we're in the very final stages of sending the June issue to print. And I don't know whether it's because in the UK there's a bank holiday on a Monday, but there seems to have been a kind of an added urgency to getting those pages out the door. I think people are keen not to be at their desks on Monday morning.
They're safeguarding their weekend. But it's been a great issue to put together. It's a nautical theme.
Well, so you're somebody who loves, you know, the feel of water around your toes, and this is a kind of a nautically themed issue. And you know, you've been in Istanbul, you've lived by the sea, so it's kind of home turf for you.
I'm just saying we should have really a sort of thesaurus of nautical terms on our desk. Keep on sort of these stevedores and all the knots and different things like that. They're all creeping into this issue.
I know, and I was writing the cover for the issue a little bit earlier, thinking, you know, how many nautical cliches and maritime elements can we work into a single couple? It is a very good, of course, segue. Of course, with the opening of our program as well. Let's just start by listening to this.
These submarines will be the most sophisticated naval vessels being built in the world. And they will be built here, in Australia, with Australian jobs, Australian steel, Australian expertise. And this will secure our successful transition to the economy of the 21st century and the jobs which our children and grandchildren are entitled to expect.
Well, Australian jobs, maybe not Australian technology, but anyway, that was the country's Prime Minister, Malcolm Turnbull, there on his plans to expand the country's submarine fleet. The French will build them, of course, much to the annoyance of Japan, which had initially been really at the forefront of winning the contract. Also, we were hearing a lot as well that Germany also thought they had it. A rather significant prize, Andrew, 50 billion Australian dollars, not quite as many euros. But what does it tell us? Because of course, oddly, we had a little cheeky periscope. I think it was the bottom left-hand corner of our page, and we had our Australia-themed issue as well, because it was a very hot topic at that point. Clearly, they must have been very close to the deal. They were obviously penning the contract at that point, and back February, March.
Well, it tells us a few things. Firstly, the need to have these submarines. Australia, we tend to think of it in the cliches as, you know, beach and relaxed and not that worried about things, but it actually sits in a part of the world where it's surrounded by opportunities and risks like everybody else. And one of those is to the south. It's got, you know, Antarctica, and it's, you know, a disputed area. It's concerned about what's going on there. And to the north, it faces, you know, what's happening in the Pacific with China, with other players there as well. So it shows that Australia is actually a big military power these days and is keen to kind of flex its muscles.
Sophie, a lot of people have said, you know, suddenly we see Australia really moving up the international submarine league tables. They're buying a vessel from France, which is top of its game in terms of conventional fleets. Do you think, are people sort of right to react and raise their eyebrows? I mean, aside from, you know, the likes of China, or is this essential for a continent of this size?
Well, I think, I mean, it's such a huge investment. I mean, they clearly think it's essential. And also, it's interesting to look at the fact they've chosen France with this alliance, because everyone thought it was going to be Japan, and that really made sense politically, because there'd be that alliance between, you know, sort of pivoting around China. But now we're seeing, you know, them coming towards Europe. It's quite an interesting political move as well.
Andrew, do you think there's also going to be, and all of these things, of course, are about technology transfer. I'm sure that, you know, the city of Melbourne, the city of Adelaide, where these vessels are going to be built, of course, suddenly this starts to spur, all kinds of other industries, whether they're sort of secondary or tertiary. Do you think it starts to also affect the vineyards, though, of South Australia?
Well, I'm sure it's going to affect the culture of the cities. There's a large number of people arrive. We see it in other, company towns, in effect, where you had maybe Japanese car makers come in the past. It does begin to affect the culture. But it is interesting, you talk about that technology transfer, and that is the feeling that in the end the Japanese lost out because they weren't so sure about that technology transfer in the beginning. And the French from the start DCNS was like, yeah, we want to move technology, we will build the boats, the ships here.
I think actually the French should be credited with some very shrewd diplomacy here, as well as lobbying, because I mean people are raising their eyebrows really at the fact they've secured this so quickly, and they were on it. They were sending leagues of diplomats over there really recently to memorial services and everything. That it was such a political offensive that I think that's a very good point to make, really.
I want to bring you in, Tyler, as well, because you go to Japan all the time, and we talk a lot about the problem for Japan Inc. is, first of all, they often have a prime minister that doesn't speak English, or people lobbying on their part that don't speak great English. The French seem much better at it. Do you think this is going to be seen as a real failure for Abe's attempts, saying, yes, we can build a military machine that's acceptable to the world, we can do better outreach for our industries?
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, one of our a very close friend to the magazine, who's also very involved, with the Australian government, I think was probably very close to this deal as well, probably lobbying, slightly on both sides. And I think, what you hear about all of this is that frustration that, that the West often has, with Japan. And I think this, here was an issue, of course, for Turnbull's government. They had to deliver, the Collins class submarines that they bought from Sweden last time, were seen really as duds. They were a failure. They've had to retire them too early. So I think also, Sophie, your point, the French were very, very shrewd. Australia had to invest in an absolutely sure bet. And we heard one of the problems, in the end was, the Japanese submarines, of course, many would say they were the best ships technically, but there was a problem that they couldn't make the beds longer. They couldn't make the crew accommodation longer. And, Australians aren't small.
No, and it's interesting. That has hit Japan Inc. before, the idea of exporting anything.
And inflexibility.
Clothing and anything. They have a way of doing it, and they're not sure.
Look how small my sweatshirt is, my shoulders. I'm wearing a Japanese sweatshirt right now.
But yes, I think that that lack of flexibility is certainly a problem that Japan has faced. But also, it is interesting how the shopping for submarines has never seemed more vital, that people are really kind of aware that you need to have something in your fleet, whether that's India, whether it's anywhere around the world. It's a good time to be a submarine maker.
Yeah, I mean, we see already, Norway have been talking, at length, saying that they need to be upgrading, their fleet, Canada as well, looking at what they do next. So yeah, just when you sort of thought, well, do we need technology like this? Seems so.
It seems so. And I mean, not to forget the Brits, who are endlessly debating whether we should invest this type of money in nuclear submarines. And I think it is amazingly decisive of the Australians to make this decision.
And these types of numbers, I think also curious as well, you know, a nation which still builds ships, you know, here we're sitting in the capital of this country, that also, that the UK didn't was not on the list, that they don't have something to offer the international market right now.
No, you get that sense with all of the kind of the naval work that Britain's done. It feels a little bit out of the game. As we talked before, it doesn't even have an aircraft carrier in service at the moment. But I think also you are aware that, you know, China and also Russia, I guess, is the other player in Europe that's making the Germans and everyone feel that they need additional submarines in their fleets because of what's happening in the Baltic and what's happening around the Arctic as well.
I mean, just over the past week, so it goes back to your point about, you know, the shuttling, you know, the real sort of shuttle diplomacy that was probably going on to make this happen. You also wonder, we had a very interesting event in Europe over the past week called Roots, and that's, you know, RUTES, you know, and this is a major sort of route swapping event where airlines and airports and regions are all getting together to decide, you know, where should European carriers be flying, etc. And you realize suddenly, you know, probably the importance, the amount of traffic suddenly that is going to, you know, be going between Paris and Adelaide. Now, there won't be maybe an excuse to have a direct daily nonstop flight. You couldn't do nonstop, I guess, at the moment. But certainly, you know, via Dubai, via elsewhere, that just there from a trade route alone. And it'll be interesting to see, you know, as Andrew, you're saying, what happens with that city, you know, 36 months from now?
Yeah, I guess, you know, for many Australians, they'll want it to remain, you know, a civilian city. They don't want it to become a barrack town. But I guess we've also seen as we've gone around the world, when we've gone to the likes of a Houston, for example, where you see the oil industry.
You love Houston.
I kind of like Houston. I have some questions about the mobility there. But what's interesting is about that when you have one powerful industry, one powerful kind of set of people working together, suddenly you get these amazing air routes from Houston. You know, they need to connect to other oil cities around the world. And that redraws the airline maps of the world.
And the point is, these are really high-skilled jobs. I mean, it's not just the bashing of steel we're going to hear here. So I think that really was the important thing for the Australians in this deal.
Indeed. And speaking of cities, it's just... Well, it's 1811 if you're listening in Lisbon or London right now. And it's just, of course, gone past 1300 lunchtime if you're listening in New York, Washington, or elsewhere. This is Midori House with me, Tyler Brulé, Andrew Tuck, and Sophie Grove. Time for a question. Are young professionals happier living in suburbia than they are in our cities? Joel Kotkin, the author of The Human City, Urbanism for the Rest of Us, certainly thinks they might be. Here's what he had to say on The Urbanist here on Monocle 24.
What we find is that millennials, as they're getting into their late 20s and early 30s, guess what they're doing? They're moving to the suburbs. When you're 23 years old, really, do you really care that much about, you know, how much space you have? You know, you don't even know where you're going to end up sleeping every night. When you get into your 30s and 40s, it's a very different situation.
Joel Kotkin there, of course, a lead commentator on urban affairs. Andrew Tuck is here. Of course, he's the host of The Urbanist. Aside from being the editor of this magazine, you're grinning, Andrew, beyond that microphone. Your take on that comment.
I like his voice, and I just like somebody who starts from the opposite end of the argument. So yeah, his shtick is, you know, that, yes, we're talking about density, we're talking about packing people in, but is there a cost that is not being recognised at the moment? So he suggests that actually... It's great if you're a singleton. It's great if you're in your early 20s. But then what happens is when people are in their 30s and they're stuck with an apartment that's tiny and they can't get married and they can't have kids. And then he says it affects everything from the birth rate in cities, which we're beginning to see change. So he's done a lot of work with the government of Singapore analysing literally why birth rates go down when people live in very packed in, dense urban settings. So he's interesting because he's saying you need to think that the suburb can be a kind of good place, can be reinvented, can be retrofitted. You can add in metro stations. You don't have to be dependent on the car. And then suddenly you will see what actually happens. And his argument is actually, if you watch all those kind of beardy tattoo types, by the time they're 30, they're going to be living somewhere with a garden. That's where they want to really be.
There's a very large question in the studio.
it's a large bump of a question.
Sophie Grove, you have your second child on the way. I want to know, what, do you have one of those houses with three garages and seven bedrooms?
No, but I do live in a place with two parks nearby, and it isn't, you know, a high-rise, amazingly sort of buzzing area. I mean, I live in London, so it isn't the the sticks. But I do think that you just have this reality check as soon as you have little legs running around, and you think
I've got little legs.
Yes, but Anne's got little legs anyway.
And you need that green space and all of your sort of, I don't know, this idea of mooching around the city, taking in that sort of New York style atmosphere becomes a little less romantic.
Mm. We say that, and yet we're huge defenders of the city centre. And when you look at the challenges of infrastructure, even in very evolved cities, that they don't have, not everything is universally accessible for prams, let alone wheelchairs, etc. Everyone's trying to retrofit. Is his argument a bit rich, Andrew, or do you think he's just trying to be a little bit ahead of the curve, or does he have a point?
I think he has a point in the sense that also when many of these developments are done, they are done without any public realm. So the amount of public realm is so minimal, there isn't actually somewhere for a kid to go and kick a ball or to play out, or for you to sunbathe, or for you to go and take a picnic outside of your apartment. So then people begin to feel claustrophobic. And even on that sense, we need to feel that there is something good around healthy architecture, which we've debated before. But also interesting, I was thinking about Toronto, a city obviously super well, but there you can be near our office, for example. You can be in a quite central location, and actually there's a good mix of density, but also houses with nice gardens and a patch out front and a place to put your pumpkin when it's Halloween night and your Christmas tree when it's Christmas. So some cities have, by luck or fate, they have a more mixed kind of housing scene anyway.
I thought you were going to talk about our bureau chief there, Thomas Lewis, who barely has little legs because he's around on crutches at the moment, the poor thing. But no, it is true when you look at a lot of North American cities, and I think also there are some European cities. When we're in Hamburg as well, I always said I sort of feel quite comfortable in Hamburg because right in the city centre, you get to the areas of Eppendorf and Winterhude, etc., and you have these amazing leafy neighbourhoods with proper lawns in the front of them and gardens. And you have that construct in many German cities, in the north. I wonder how much of this is also an economic argument that Kotkin's bringing up, though, because is he also just saying, well, it just makes sense. We've seen this sort of great flight into the city center. It's easier. You don't have to commute, all of those things. So does he want to be part of the curve of, the groovy set is going to be living there. And there's a value for money argument maybe in it as well.
Yeah, and I think also part of the argument is, if you want to keep people staying in your cities, you see it in many cities which become expensive, which become kind of difficult to live in and navigate if you have kids. If you want to keep people there, then you need to have a more diverse approach to housing and make sure that there are kind of places for everyone to kind of rest at the end of the day.
Sophie, are you hunting now? You've heard this. You're sort of scanning websites and pages to see if you can trade up further out?
Well, I'm actually trading into, I've been looking at apartments in Paris. And, the Haussmannian classic apartment is a great family place to live, which shows you it's about design. And if we have apartments that make people feel that there is a sense of expanse and they can see a tree from the window, they'll live there forever.
And a tricycle hurtling between lovely interconnecting rooms in the centre of Paris,
exactly.
On great parquet.
Exactly.
It's 1817 here in London. You're listening to Midori House with me, Tyler Brulé, Andrew Tuck, and Sophie Grove. Coming up, Herman Melville said, "It is better to fall in originality than to succeed in imitation. But does it matter if we borrow or better the ideas of others?" We'll discuss that right after this.
Just grow like a tree with the roots very deep on earth.
For the best in food and hospitality, tune into The Menu.
I learned that from a potato farmer way up in northern Maine. And he baked me a potato and it was like eating the best thing ever.
Monaco's program on food and drink introduces you to the most inspirational chefs, dedicated producers and innovative restaurateurs.
Some cinnamon syrup, a half an ounce of that. Got our Bosca Schnapps, an ounce of this.
So when you need inspiration for your dinner plans or want to find a new place for a superb cocktail, tune into The Menu with me, Marcus Hippi, premiering every Friday at 1900 London time.
It was really the River Cafe where I really just had a deep relationship with carrots. Vegetables, sorry, I said to say carrots, but I love carrots, so I meant vegetables in general.
A And you're back with Midori House here in Studio One in the heart of London, I might add. It is a Friday afternoon. I can almost hear the clinking of ice and glasses and gin and tonics being poured upstairs.
I hope so.
I can bring them down. I'm not sure if we can last another 11 minutes. Anyway, our sister program, The Globalist, has been discussing this week whether originality matters. This is what Mark Earls, a philosopher and the author of Copy, 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 had to say about it a little earlier today.
It starts with other people. Each of us doesn't start with a blank sheet of paper, doesn't start with just being the first person to have thought about a problem like this. There's generations of people behind us, and there are lots of peers around us. So we pick up things that happen to be around and make use of them. Grayson Perry put it in his Reith lectures really clearly. He said that originality is for those people with short memories.
Mark Earls, philosopher and author, on The Globalist a little bit earlier today. Sophie, copy, copy, copy. There's a lot of copy, copy, copy floating around in our different kind, but there's just a lot of words hurtling around in this building right now as we ship the June issue off. But on that point, it's interesting, we were talking about Japan a little bit earlier, losing a sub deal. You could argue that, everyone is producing a very, very good sub at the moment. Everyone is spying on each other, we could argue as well. Does it matter, unless we're talking about sort of the most original of ideas and there are huge IP issues at hand? What's your take on what he had to say?
I mean, it's really... You can see that there are so many entrepreneurs sitting around, thinking as hard as they can to think of something that's genuinely original. And that could be, a huge impediment to them just starting a business, which could be a really fantastic, lucrative concept. Mm. And I think it is... people are fixated with just that original invention when actually, really, they could reinvent something. Mm. And that's what we find in the magazine. I've just been editing a great piece on Murano glass by Chiara Rimella. And, those people are doing something that's been around before the 13th century on that island. Mm. And they are innovating. They're certainly not doing anything new.
Mm. Andrew, if I even think about our New Nations book that is out as well, much of it is a series of benchmarks. And when we talked about that book, we're saying to governments, in a way, you don't need to go and invest tens of millions with consultants to come and think of something brilliant and new, when maybe you can just go to Tallinn or you can fly to Jakarta because they've already done it and you might as well just lift what they've done.
I think whether you're running a city hall, a government, or a business, sometimes it's very good just to go and see what other people are doing in your field. When we did the business book, for example, we covered a whole generation of people who'd found success and were having great lives and earning good money by finding businesses that had kind of slightly fallen by the wayside. And they went and slightly reinvented them. They gave them modest tweaks, and that was the energy enough to get them going again. It's the same, as you say, with the Nations book. We're saying, actually, here's a good example of, an embassy or a parliament that kind of works really well. You don't have to be crazy and high tech. I often think about originality as well. Originality can quite easily end up in kind of like weird. You occasionally see there's a gentleman who walks around here in our neighbourhood who's a very original dresser, but I don't think that's what everyone would want. This is the gentleman with the very light, long white socks up to his knees.
Well, I was also thinking about trousers under his armpits.
Yes.
But at the same time, though, we say all of this, and there was a magazine which still exists on the continent, which, completely lifted... Yeah, Monocle's design, Monocle's content, Monocle's paper, everything. Would you say that they did a bit of benchmarking? Or is this just downright plagiarism and they shall be thrown into prison?
Well, I think it was when we were in Singapore, someone said to us, I've got a company and I did a project. And I just said to my team, don't have any ideas, just look at Monocle.
I've heard that before too.
I know, you're like, okay.
Or were they the ones who had the hotel in Malaysia then, which has the identical M, maybe, but anyway. Because that does irk us. And, yes, it's great that we can go and say to governments, go and copy, what's happening in Indonesia or Finland or Estonia. But at the same time, if you were the one who originally went and spent a lot of money on those consultants to come up with the original idea, is it a bit irksome?
No, but then the originality, you know, that's wrong and that is just copying. But what you don't want is somebody who thinks that, you know, the shape of the regular magazine is bizarre. It should be long, narrow and thin. Or you don't want somebody reinventing every element of it. You think, okay, there are some things we understand work. Paper works, a spine works, this trim works. Go with some of the things we understand fit into the palm of a hand. So you've got some starting points.
Yep.
And then, of course, then you have to add the things which are fresh and new and aren't stolen. But, you know, I don't think that you have to think every single element. I think, as Sophie said, you really get the feeling that many people never end up running a business, never end up doing anything interesting because they're always looking for the wacky, new, the completely different. And you don't need to do that.
I mean, it really does. It does make me feel a bit cross when I see those rip-offs. But at the same time, if you compare that to, for instance, the technology industry, you know, graphene, for instance, was invented in Manchester. It's been patented over 2,000 times in China, and the British have done virtually nothing with it. So in a way, that invention is the beginning of something, and then people sort of riff on it, take it to other places. I mean, it's probably not a comparison with Monocle magazine.
Maybe not. And I think it's interesting, you know, we have mood boards for a reason.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
and it's incredible how often you see them going out of this building. And Inbound, as well as our sister company, you know, is out doing pitches, etc. And also how much that becomes a part of a brief as well. Someone who has a massive legal department and, you know, they hand you this, here's the brief, and it's an image, but, you know, how can you enhance it and make it better?
But I also think originality can scare people and stop things taking off. You know, when we started Monocle, one of the interesting things was, you know, we went out to market with a magazine that just mixed in a magazine format what you'd find in your newspaper. Obviously, as we all know, we have, you know, fashion, business, design. But that kind of, even that was enough to kind of scare some people. It took a while for people to get their heads around it. So I think even then, if you'd done anything more, you know, unusual, it would have been difficult to bring people along on the journey.
It's just 18:25. Gives us a few minutes to talk about things that are coming up, not just on our airwaves next week, but we can also talk about probably other things on the go. I'm going to start, and if you're listening on the West Coast or anywhere else, but if you happen to be in Vancouver on Monday evening, Seattle on Tuesday evening, or in San Francisco on Wednesday, we are going to be having the Almost Cascadia Northern California signing series for our book on Nations. So our Thomas Lewis will be on hand. Our Keen Knapp will also be there from Toronto. So we look forward to seeing any of our audience who happen to be in and around the area. Looking forward to seeing people. And that's what I'm up to, Andrew.
Well, on The Globalist next week, they're going to have a whole series looking at borders. We tend to think of our countries as fixed entities, but you only have to pick up an atlas from 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 20 years ago to see how many changes there have been. And at the moment, there are all sorts of disputes and potential changes going on. And I know that one of the things that Henry Rhys Sheridan, who's going to be looking at the series for us, he's going to be looking at the Golan Heights, because the Israelis are scared that a peace deal with Syria may include rewriting the borders to give the Golan Heights back one day to Syria. And they're determined for that not to happen.
And we'll be, I guess, hearing quite a bit as well from our Tim Marshall. No, our Tim Marshall. He sort of feels like our Tim Marshall, because he's often a bit of a fixture on the sofa running his office out of the lobby of this building. But he's written a book, Prisoners of Geography. We'll be hearing quite a bit from him as well. Sophie.
I'm excited to hear about Ecuador and Peru, who are creating...
Are you really excited?
Yeah, genuinely. The region's first binational biosphere reserve on a shared border, which is kind of new take on the border, sort of pooling...
pooling animals, you know, yeah. Trees, everything else you want. Andrew,
sorry. And the other thing here in the office, next week we begin, as June leaves, we begin... The very tough task.
Who's leaving?
June. Oh. June. Oh. She's my friend. She's been here a few weeks now. She's off.
I haven't met her yet.
Very, very nice woman. But anyway, we're going to be starting in July, August, which is, of course, the quality of life survey. So I know Steve has been kind of getting his little teeth into the kind of all the metrics that we need to kind of like assess.
Does he have little teeth?
He's like, you have to watch out when you put your hand in the cage.
This is true. No, he's been pitching also some new ideas in terms of our metrics. It was amazing. You said the other day that we started with just 20 metrics when we look at cities. It's now grown to 60. A little bit of a previous to how we might sort of change things up a little bit.
Well, one of the things we've tried to do over time is kind of stretch the metrics to cover a bit more fun and a bit more grit in cities. So one of the elements we're going to be looking at in depth this year is the nighttime and the nighttime economy and cities which know that fun is important for keeping people in your city, attracting people to your city, and just kind of, you know, keeping the culture going as well.
Mm, so just to, before we go, Sophia, weekend plans very quickly.
Oh, the coast. I'm inspired.
Well, as Andrew said, you know, a little bit of salty water around your ankles. Very nice. Andrew?
There's going to be some coast probably next week, but I'm going to Mexico City on Sunday.
Oh, very nice. Olé.
Olé. How about that?
Sombreros all around when you come back. Oh. Andrew Tuck, Sophie Grove, very good to see you. I'll be seeing you in about 30 seconds upstairs. That is all the time we have for today, and really for this week, at least on this particular program. Today's show is produced by Rhys James, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Ilse Viveros. Our studio manager, yeah, it's Chris Chilvers, just wanted to check. He's been the one keeping us on air. Midori House is back at the very same time on Monday at 1800. I'm Tyler Brulé. Have a very good weekend. Thanks so much. Goodbye.